All right, hit me.
We could do a quick fire round on listener questions.
Quick fire, let's do it. Rapid fire questions, then we talk about how we design for Commander, and then we gracefully exit. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right.
All right. Okay. I'm Phil DeLuca.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And I'm Sean Watson.
And we are Commander In. Yeah! Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to put a spotlight on community issues, but never, ever talk about three banned topics: religion, politics, and Hearthstone. Remember to check us out on Twitter at CommanderAndMTG and talk to us there. This week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. We have a very special guest. He is the winner of the Great Designer Search 2. He is the lead designer on Journey into Nyx, Commander 2014, and Oath of the Gatewatch. It's Ethan Fleischer.
Yay.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show, and you're absolutely welcome here anytime you want. We really appreciate you taking the time to come over, especially at the end of the spoiler season for Oath of the Gatewatch.
Spoiler season is my favorite season of the year, and it comes 4 times a year. 5 times if you count commander sets.
6 if you count the supplemental set in the summer.
Oh my god. We get so many times of the year with Magic the Gathering. I love it.
Yeah, it's great. This is our favorite time as well.
Are we all doing pre-releases next week? I mean, I presume Ethan's been playing with this for a long time, but...
Oh, yeah, but it's a lot more fun to play with the actual cards than with the poorly tested and artless versions that we play test with.
I imagine you do it with a deck full of, like, napkins with ideas scrawled on them, and you try and shuffle them up, and one of you spills a soda and puts his drink down on the napkins, and that was my deck. Ah,
that, no? That's about how it goes.
Do you double sleeve the napkins?
We don't really have time for double sleeving. We just do regular single sleeves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, otherwise the napkins would fall apart pretty quickly, so.
Think of the money.
You guys actually have an employee pre-release, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. We have a pre-release. It's structured a little bit differently than a regular pre-release. So we have a giant room that we open up, and you can just come in at any time during the 6 hours that the pre-release is going on, play 4 matches or 3 matches. I don't remember. I can't remember how many it is. But you play a few matches, and then you get a bigger prize for winning more matches than losing matches. But the prize structure is pretty flat, and the main idea is to just have a lot of fun and play with some people that you don't usually work with, so get to meet some people that way.
That's cool. You get folks from all around the company?
Oh, yeah. It's very popular. It's gotten a lot more popular in the last few years also. I think it's really exploded.
Do you ever kind of gloat to the Dungeons & Dragons people?
No. I don't want to make them feel bad about how awesome we are.
All I'm looking for is one beholder, though.
Oh, man, that would be so
cool. You've already got cards
cool.
with eyeballs.
A beholder card? I would love to do that sometime, but I don't know. I don't know how to make it happen.
Well, you'd have to call it
the
something different.
The brand folks are very adamant that these two properties remain distinct from each other.
I'd love to see, like, some little, like, old lady unassuming Debbie from accounting comes in and absolutely schools you all. She's actually a closet pro, comes in. She's just, you know, going to take down the pro tour next year, but none of you even knew she played Magic. She just works in the office.
Yeah. Do you ever have anybody like that? Somebody you don't expect comes out and just, like, stomps all over the pre-release?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't heavily involved, or really involved at all, I should say, in the competitive tournament scene, and so every once in a while, someone will just appear and just destroy me, and I'll be like, who was that? Oh, yeah, that was somebody who works in the production department, and he used to be on the Pro Tour. He's a Hall of Fame member or whatever. It's like, oh, well, I wasn't expecting that. But he just designed packages.
Incredible.
I don't know.
Yeah, I could be out stomping people on the Pro Tour, but, you know, I wanted to work on the borders, the packaging.
It's very controversial, card borders. Yeah.
They would be the spikiest card borders ever.
They would. Very, very competitive package designers.
As implied by the name, we are a Commander-oriented podcast. You have some familiarity with Commander, isn't that correct?
Yes, Commander is the greatest of all formats, and I'm sure we all agree about that.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
So what was the last, here's the real test, what was the last Commander game you played?
So that would have been a few hours ago. I played with my Recce, the History of Kamigawa, mono green deck, and there was some Grenzo deck, and there were a bunch of vampires, and there was a vampire that whenever something dies, it can deal a damage to one of your opponents, and all of a sudden, like, 50 or 60 creatures died all at once, and my opponent just killed all three of her opponents, and we're all dead. But it was after a long and exciting game with lots of twists and turns, and so all good things must come to an end. She was like, I have to leave in about 10 minutes. I'm just going to kill you guys now. So we all went down in flames.
Do you have any table rules where it's sort of like, okay, we're not going to combo out until 90 minutes in, or do you just play?
My only table rule is we don't talk about Commander Mulligans. It's just like Fight Club.
What do you mean?
Just my rule is we don't talk about Commander Mulligans. Just do what you have to do. I don't want to hear about it, and I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, okay, great.
It's not a bad rule. Yeah, I don't care that you're hard mulliganing for your Sarah Ascendant. Great, go for it. Just keep going. Yeah.
Even if you see somebody doing that, you don't call them out on it?
Oh, no, I wouldn't. I mean, if I saw someone blatantly cheating at some point, I would make fun of them, but that's about as far as it would go.
Mm. That's fair. I guess if they need to, then you just let them.
Yeah, yeah.
You're all there to have fun.
Exactly,
anyway, right?
Exactly. Part of the fun is making fun of people.
I take a slightly different approach to cheats on my table. If they're cheating, and I can spot it, but it's not like, you know, a massive game-breaking cheat. They're just, you know, maybe...
counter on.
Yeah, things like that. I'll just make a point of ruining their game with my game. I'll just stop them doing stuff, even if it's at my detriment. And you might think, well, why are you ruining your own fun? No, I quite enjoy ruining a cheat day.
Yeah, I mean, if it was somebody actually sneakily trying to cheat, then I could see doing something like that. But usually in this case, it's like, I'm going to basic land cycle this card now. Watch me do it. And everyone would be like, okay, but you better really need it.
So now, Nate, you've been away, most of our listeners don't realize this, but you've been away in your annual hibernation, basically sleeping for the entire year, all in the, you know, 3 weeks at the end of the year. Nate, since the ice counters were removed, you've been able to come out of that slumber.
Yeah.
Have you managed to play in the last day or two?
I've been playing Fallout 4, and I could talk about that to some length. But let's see, the last Commander game I played, I got to say, with Battle for Zendikar, and I've seen some new toys in Oath of the Gatewatch, too.
Oh, yeah.
Mardu allies is a thing now.
Mm.
And even just going vampire allies as just a sub-tribe of Vishkal, that works, too. There's a lot of great allies in the Mardu colors, especially, in my opinion.
Well, there's a five-color ally commander coming now, isn't there?
Toss yeah, me. Whatever.
So who would your commander be in Mardu allies?
Ironically, not an ally. I would use Alicia, who smiles at death because of the battlefield recursion and the rally ability for the enter the battlefield effects.
That seems like an excellent choice and a very smartly and beautifully designed card, I might add.
Oh, did you have something to do with it?
Of course.
That's excellent. I've played against Nate's Alicia deck, and it's misery. It's misery on a stick, and he hits me with it all the time.
I enjoy playing that deck. It's a challenge. You have to keep right up on top of it. So I like it. I like playing when I've got the pressure on, and that's a deck when it keeps the pressure on me. So yeah, it's good. It's a deck that you don't mind losing to. I'll put it that way.
It's very fun. It's acrobatic.
Yeah.
So Sean, what was the last commander you used?
The last commander I used was, Phil, get ready for a Phil moan, was Sheldred, the Whispering One. So I was on an 8-game winning streak. to which listener now added into the hallowed halls of a friend of the show, Robin Cass, decided his mission was to break my 8-game winning streak. and he did it with some great aplomb and took me down like the punk I am. But everyone was using Merrin. It seems like every game I've played, no matter who the opponents are, someone in the group has turned up with a Merrin clan of Clan Neltoff deck, which I have one myself. So I thought, you know, I'm going to start using my original Merrin deck, which was my Mono Black Sheldra deck, and was finding, because it's very tuned and builds into the strengths of black, shall we say, tutors, it's very efficient, and I've been doing quite well with that. So
yours is not a 75% deck?
That deck, absolutely not, no. It is 100%. Although, I'd say that, I think it's 95%, because it doesn't have any sort of two-card combo outs. It's not going to go Mikaios, Triskelion, and I win, or anything like that. But what it will do is mean you can never play creatures. So if you play a creatureless deck, it takes it down really fast. Or if you play an enchantment slash artifact heavy deck and use them to win, I'm in a lot of trouble as well. But other than that, it's fairly solid.
Excellent. I ended up dabbling. I'm still playtesting the new commanders from 2015. And I ended up with I built a Mizzix X deck, right? Where many of the spells are big X spells. And it was interesting. It has potential. It was certainly a lot more entertaining than Melek. I could have gone.
Wait. We need to check. Ethan, you didn't have anything to do with the designing of Melek. Is it Paragon, did you?
No. I mean, I was on the design team for that product, but I was working on the Simic deck, not the Izzet deck.
That's fine. Okay, carry on. Melek's terrible, by the way. Carry on, Phil.
That's great.
We just needed to check before we crapped on one of Ethan's babies, you know.
I have made my share of blunders, let's just put it that way, and I own up to them.
That's certainly more interesting than talking about a Mizzix X deck, which looks like every other Mizzix X deck in the world. So what's a good blunder?
The two greatest sins that I've committed against my favorite format are Sylvan Primordial, had to be banned.
You! And, it was you!
To my credit, when I turned it over to the development team, it did not search for lands. It merely acidic slimed everyone. And then my other and perhaps greater sin was Derevi, Imperial Tactician, a card that we just kept piling abilities on until it became a tool for ultimate evil. that was never my intent. I thought it was just a bit of harmless fun, and it never even occurred to me what miserable decks people would make with it.
Yeah, well, that's banned.
I made a bird tribal.
See, you were doing it right. That's perfectly fine, right?
Yeah, he did that for Thanksgiving, and playtesting against that was brutal too.
It even won a game.
It took out my very tuned Lazav deck. I said, well, fair play. I deserve that.
Yeah. And he did it even without stacks.
Yeah. Bant stacks was your fault, basically. Because Rafik of the Many wasn't a powerful enough commander for that color, which... shard. Thanks, Ethan. Thanks.
Yeah. It was my pleasure.
Did you design Containment Priest as a sort of sorry to the fans? Was that you?
Because that was
that fixes Derevi.
Yeah, I wasn't really aimed at Derevi specifically. It was considered. I was kind of aiming it more as a vintage card that would just hose all sorts of cheating, any sort of shenanigans.
Oh yeah,
you could be up to show and tell or tinker or what have you would be hosed by Containment Priest. And yes, Derevi is also hosed by Containment Priest. But yeah, there are all sorts of miserable things that Containment Priest takes care of, and I like that about
it. It's
that
a
card.
Marvelous card.
I like it too. Yeah. I like cards that hose lots of other cards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Hate Bears, the 2-mana 2/2 that has some ability that prevents your opponent from doing what they thought they were going to be doing this game.
Oh, Meddling Mage is my favorite Hate Bear then, because it stops my opponent from playing their commander this game.
That is brutal.
Now, if only someone had recently designed a new sort of super Meddling Mage that I could put in all my decks and abuse the hell out of, that would be really helpful, Ethan.
I'll keep it in mind.
Oh, look, you've already done it.
If that card were to exist, surely it wouldn't have an enter the battlefield effect that could be abused with Brago.
I think that could be arranged. You know what my address is. I take checks.
Oh, the new version of Linvala would go pretty well with Flicker Dex.
That is true, especially if you are behind. That will catch you up right quickly.
Yeah. Hey, so why does that Linvala produce a 3-3 angel instead of a 4-4? Was 4-4 just, did it bust the standard meta wide open?
I can only assume that it's just everybody was playing Linvala and nobody was playing anything else. I don't know. That card was designed while the set was in development, and so I was not heavily involved in that. Generally, the designers are not as involved in constructed playtesting as we are in limited playtesting.
Mark is pretty open about all of that on his podcasts and the blogs. And so when we say we're somewhat familiar, obviously we're listening to the media about the design process, right? That covers the design process. I don't want to lose something. You mentioned Containment Priest. Did you aim that specifically at the abusive legacy cards?
Yeah, I was there. For the first few Commander sets, we wanted to put some Vintage and Legacy aimed cards that were intended to be played in those formats, into the product to, you know, boost sales a little bit. For 2015, we didn't do that. We decided that that was not actually very fun for the Commander players, because all these Vintage and Legacy players were buying the boxes and they couldn't find the Commander that they wanted, the Commander deck that they wanted at the store. So for 2015, we did not have any Eternal Shots, but for the previous few Commander products, we did have cards that were specifically designed for those formats that we put in there to incentivize people a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
True Name Nemesis, Containment Priest, anything else?
Oh, yeah. What is that thing called? Toxic Deluge was one. Fluster Storm. Let me think. That ooze. The ooze that eats things. Scavenging Ooze.
Oh, that's a great
Those
card.
Are all examples of Eternal Shots that we put in there. But, yeah, we don't really feel like the behavior that created was desirable, so we stopped doing that.
It was really hard to get in the stores. Of the Mindseize Grixis deck for a long time.
Yeah, it was really hard. In fact, we had to, for a while, release boxes that had twice as many Mindseize as the other boxes in them, just to keep up with the demand.
Wow, that's crazy. It's kind of your hoist by your own petard, as it were, right? Your own success contributed to your own problems.
Yeah, it just sort of deformed the incentives in people's buying habits to the point where it was just making people unhappy. So we changed it.
So yeah. As a designer, you're trying to make sure that each of the five Commander products sells pretty much equally well.
That's right. Because when a store sells out of one of them, they come in a box with all five of the smaller boxes inside. So they have to reorder all five at the same time.
So can you say whether that affected why Blade of Selves went into the Boros deck?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if that was, I feel like Blade of Selves was a big success in that a lot of people wanted it, probably more than we anticipated.
Yeah, it's a game ending card. I think
all at once.
I think to touch what Nate was saying, there's a perception amongst Commander players, rightly or wrongly, that Boros is the weakest of the two color pairings.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, red and white are individually the weakest colors in Commander, and they don't shore up each other's strengths very effectively in multiplayer either.
No, you're not wrong. So there's a perception, I think, amongst some of the community that the Blade of Selves is objectively the most quote-unquote powerful card in the Commander 2015 set, so it was put into the weakest guild pairing without it necessarily synergizing with the rest of the deck.
Oh, well. Yeah, I hadn't heard that before, so I couldn't speak to that. That, again, came out in the development team. The development team were the ones who made that piece of equipment. Yeah, we designed the mechanic and the cycle of five creatures with the myriad mechanic. And then I believe that the equipment was created in development. I'm not positive about that, but I believe that was the case.
Brings me to a quick design question. I'm skipping slightly ahead to designing Commander sets here. But so when you're... design, this will answer the question about the Blade of Selves as well, I guess. When you're designing a set for like Commander 2015, a Commander set, do you design decks or do you design cards and then build decks out of them, looking at the sort of pool of resources available to you as regards reprints and stuff? Yeah, what's that kind of process for how you put the deck together?
Can you walk us through the design process? I mean, Sean's question points to that, but like go all the way out, back out and say like, how do you start with a commander? Like, what's the concepting process for a commander deck all the way through development?
Absolutely. So what we do is we convene the design team, and generally we'll have five members of the design team, and there are five decks in the product. We'll discuss what should we do this year. Well, do we want to do three colors again? Do we want to do two colors? Are we going to do monocolor? So we'll spend the first few weeks kind of discussing what the overall scheme is going to be and what the plan is and exploring different options. And then we will assign, or people will select, which deck they want to work on. So for Commander 2014, which was the set that I led, we talked about what colors are we going to do. I mentioned that I'd done a little research that indicated that monocolored decks were surprisingly popular, and I thought it would be a great challenge for us to try to make monocolor pre-constructed decks and make a few cards to sort of help the monocolored decks along and make them work a little better. So we did that, and then each of us chose a color, and my procedure is the person with the least design experience gets first pick of their color, and then we go in reverse order of seniority to the most experienced, and that way people who are more experienced can have a, you know, will take on the bigger challenges, the ones that seem harder. They're more likely to be equipped to handle those challenges.
Which one did you end up with?
I ended up with the red deck.
I thought so.
So I had was it fourth pick out of the five of us. Aaron Forsyth, of course, is the director of Magic R&D, and so he got last choice. But it was the color he wanted, so it all worked out for everyone. I believe everyone ended up with the color they wanted anyway.
Did he get white?
He got green.
Oh, wow. That was the last pick. That surprises me.
I was just going to say Charles Rapkin was the least experienced. He works for our organized play department, but he's a huge Commander fan, and he just loves mono white. He loves Cat Tribal and stuff, so he first picked white.
Yeah, very cool.
Meow.
I love mono red decks. I have three mono red decks of my own, so it was fun to get back into something that I felt like I knew quite a bit about, designing red decks.
So you did Duretti.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that having a red artifact themed deck has prevented design from releasing, and is it Thopter Queen?
Is exactly where I was going.
I knew this was going to come up. I knew it. Yeah, people have been asking for an Is It Commander, at least as far as I can tell. The big outcry began around the time Magic Origins came out. It's possible that some were asking earlier, but that's when it really got onto our radar. So yeah, that I don't think it prevents us from doing that. I think that it prevented us from doing it the following year, because we don't want to repeat the same sort of theme 2 years in a row if we can avoid it. But it's certainly on our radar that the fans want it, and I am a big proponent of giving the fans what they want. So it will happen eventually, but it has to wait for the appropriate moment and the appropriate product.
There's going to be a point down the line where I'm getting smashed in the face by Thopter Queen Thopters, and I'm going to scream, Fleischer!
Well, I'm kind of, you know, I was one of those who was hoping for an artifact theme Is It Commander. But, you know, I think we have a lot more exploration to do with respect to Is It card draw and or caring about instants and sorceries. So I'm looking forward to another couple of years of maybe some sort of wizard.
Yeah, wizards are great.
That maybe it looks at the top card of the deck and gives you some sort of benefit if it's an instant or sorcery.
What a weird suggestion.
Oh, can you please name it Thopter Queen? Because we have some good song parodies lined up.
Thopter Queen, and looks for instants and sorceries.
We should release an album of just covers of Dancing Queen with different magic cards as the lyrics.
Yeah. So one of the questions I have, I play Commander because back in the day, actually, when I first met Nate, we played regular, you know, 60 card Magic, but we did it in a multiplayer setting. It was so much more enjoyable than just facing off against one person, because if that person, at the time it was a stasis deck, this is 1995, 96, if that person had a stasis deck, it was like, all right, fine, and, you know, let's watch you play Magic while I just sit here and you beat me up. And so in a multiplayer format, we were able to politic and check
check each other, and it wasn't as easy for that person with the stasis deck to win, and they had to, you know, really get that lock on. So when I was introduced to Commander, I realized that it had this amazing story potential. In the first couple of games I played, and by first couple I mean maybe the first two or three dozen, I kind of wrote a story that reflected what happened there. Why don't the Commander sets, and we have totally dived into designing Commander, and I apologize for that, Ethan, because we do want to talk about Oath too, just as badly. But why don't the Commander sets have some sort of unifying story, you know, where the Vorthoses among us, if you will, would really kind of appreciate that?
One of the reasons that the Commander decks that we release aren't very creatively cohesive, there's sort of two reasons. One of them is that we want to have a freedom to show people lots of different things. We want to have like a melange of different characters from different places, and it's just, there's a freedom there, because when we release a regular set, everything has to be in the same world, all the characters are in the same place at the same time, and it's nice to have a break from that. The other reason is, generally, to make an effective Commander deck that plays well, that's powerful enough and is fun enough, you need to take Magic cards from lots of different sets and combine them together. And so when you do that, obviously they all have a different creative treatment and it becomes this mishmash. So we avoid that sort of cohesive identity there from a creative standpoint, for the most part.
Right, so it gives you the freedom, and because these characters tend not to planeswalk, they are kind of set in their own setting, like Azuri is set in New Phyrexia.
Yeah, and like we have a card associated with Azuri. There's a living weapon card in the in that deck, so that you can sort of connect those two things together, but there's not a huge amount of connection. I just realized I forgot to tell you the second half of how we design a Commander set.
Yeah, so we went off on a tangent. My apologies.
We did. We tangented.
We're good at that.
So each of us will build a deck to a theme, and we try to make sure that it's a theme that has enough support that the that we can find reprint cards and enough reprint cards so that there are too many, essentially, so that the player who buys the deck will have an opportunity to customize it a little bit and expand it and make it better. And then, of course, we make new cards. And generally, the new cards aren't heavily themed to the deck that we're going to put them in. We're just trying to make really cool cards that we think will appeal to Commander players. And then we slot them into the deck where we think they fit the best. So a lot of the time, you won't see something that's like super thematic to the set. It's just a cool multiplayer card. So after we've refined those decks and play tested for a few months, we hand them over to the next team, which is the development team, which is essentially just a second design team.
Yeah.
That improves the decks and adjusts the mana costs and redesigns cards that turned out not to be as fun as we thought they were going to be, things like that, and just makes everything better, makes everything more fun, and fixes the crappy mana systems that we put in and things like that. And then they go off to the creative department, who concepts the new cards and sometimes recommissions art if there's old art that we'd like to replace for reprint cards. And the editing team, of course, fixes them all up. And then the cards are printed and packaged and sent to your store.
Does Wizards sort of have a budget for new commissioned art? And I'm not saying like an absolute dollar value, although I know it comes down to that, but something like, I think we're going to get, 13 new pieces of art this time around.
Yeah, we budget that out and plan it. And, sometimes there's a reason to go over, and sometimes it's like, well, actually, most of these cards look pretty good. Let's just leave them the way they are and save that money for something else. So it's a little bit flexible. We have art directors who have some discretion over that. But in general, you only get so many new pieces.
So yeah. When talking art and these new sets, for example, the C14 white deck had a lot of seeded Hedrons and Zendikar art, I presume because Nahiri. How much was that intentional, knowing that Battle for Zendikar was coming, which obviously you knew it was coming, or how much was that was just a lucky coincidence that you happened to get like one of the key Zendikarian characters that we've never explored before in Magic and you could tie it into a coming set?
Well, we definitely knew that Battle for Zendikar was coming up, and there was this character from the past that we had hinted at and hadn't really talked about in any detail. So the creative team thought, oh, this is a great opportunity for us to kind of go back and give this character some backstory so that by the time we get to Battle for Zendikar, they'll be invested in this character. And I think it paid off beautifully. I really feel like the audience knew who Nahiri was and understood why she was important by the time we got to Battle for Zendikar, and I really loved that.
So that's cool. Yeah.
She's the second most asked after character.
That's right. Everyone wants to know where's Nahiri.
I presume the other character is a certain Eldrazi who's missing.
Right, where's Emrakul?
Yeah. Vorthos Mike asked that question of us.
Mm. It's true. Yes, Emrakul had been on Zendikar, but sometime in between Rise of the Eldrazi and Battle for Zendikar, she left the plane and has not been seen or heard from since.
Mm.
I wonder if she's going to visit her old pal Sorin, maybe.
She's been spotted in a lot of modern decks.
She moved.
Well, from what I've heard, there are shadows over Innistrad.
What?
Which would imply that there's something large and flying and possibly angry at someone who lives in Innistrad.
You don't think that since Shadows over Innistrad was once the third set of the Battle for Zendikar block, that there might be Eldrazi in that set, do you, Nate?
You mean a large flying Eldrazi that
maybe
everyone asks about?
Maybe.
Who knows? Who knows?
I'm just using logic here.
There's no character in the Innistrad story that has anything to do with Eldrazi. Oh, hang on.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, since nobody who knows anything about that set is listening right now.
Would be.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know a thing about that set. They they didn't let me any in the room when they were working on it.
Yeah. I guess MTG Salvation has that credit wrong. And so does announcing Shadows Over. Never mind. Well, yeah, obviously we're pretty excited. And the three of us are fun storytellers.
I would very much like to see a non-banned in our format Emrakul card, so I can have all three of the Titans in my Grufix deck.
I absolutely would too. I'm a huge Emrakul fan and enjoy playing her in the formats in which she is legal, but yeah, hopefully she'll come back one of these days.
Just don't design her to be broken that only modern players can play over. Because the plane she's currently in is a plane where commons and uncommons have an overinflated price if they fit the format correctly. And you get first turn wins with unbeatable god hands. And she's feasting on that plane.
You were selected in part because of your world-building abilities, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I was in a contest called the Great Designer Search 2, and so the contest was sort of a apprentice-style, Project Runway-style series of fiendish design challenges overseen by Mark Rosewater, who's the head designer of Magic the Gathering. And so I had
the head fiend, as it were.
He was the head fiend of the hell that is Wizards of the Coast. So I had to come up with a concept for a new plane and figure out what kinds of cards would go there and then design the cards that fit that plane mechanically and creatively.
What was your plane? What was your plane?
My plane was called Epilith, which was a prehistoric, a Stone Age plane. My concept was that each set in the block would progress to another age of technology, so it would go from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age to the Iron Age.
Oh, that's cool.
And then the twist at the end was that it was really Dominaria the whole time.
Dun, dun, dun.
I would play
Dominaria
that.
Dominaria was the first setting for the first Magic set and many Magic sets after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, including the Urza's block. Started in Dominaria and then went to other planes. That's where I came into Magic. Ugh. I would play that set, design that set, release it.
Yeah.
What sort of spells would dinosaurs cast?
Well, my idea was that there were humans there, and I feel like you need intelligent creatures to have magic. I think of magic as a sort of anthropological concept. I know that's not shared by necessarily all of the other people who work at Wizards, but
there are Baloths that would disagree with you.
Yeah. So, but then I was convinced, very easily convinced, to put dinosaurs in my set. I'm a huge dinosaur fan, so it didn't take much to talk me into spicing things up with some giant monsters.
Yeah, that's cool.
So to paraphrase, you had humans and dinosaurs living together in some sort of intelligent design?
Well, I guess so. It sounds so sordid the way you put it.
Humans and dinosaurs living together. Mass hysteria.
Would that first set have taken place about 6,000 years before the final set?
No, I would think it would be a lot earlier than that. I mean, it took hundreds of thousands of years, right, to get from the Paleolithic to the Bronze Age.
No. Welcome to Commanderin, where we marry commander formats and creationist belief into one wonderful Ironically, if you search Commander in without the MTG on the end, you get a load of pro-Christian websites come up. So we get a combination of that and people talking about the Commander-in-Chief, sort of George W. Bush flag-waving stuff. There you go. I've got politics in there as well. Anyone want to mention?
Oh, good.
Anyone want to get Hearthstone in there just to finish the
trilogy? So do you play Hearthstone?
I've actually never played Hearthstone.
And you should stay like that.
It's a very, very well-designed game.
It is.
I really appreciate a lot of things about it. It will never replace Magic in my heart, but they do.
But as a game designer, you have to do the research.
We have to. I have to play all kinds of games.
It's
part of my job.
I talk about
it's really tough.
Magic from its design perspective, is it's designed like the electric guitar. So the original Fender solid body electric guitar, the Telecaster. The original design for that product was so perfect, everyone else is either imitating or merely refining. And that's what Magic is to CCGs. It was a perfect initial design, and everyone else Yu-Gi-Oh, all these things, are just taking basic concepts that Magic brought to us and trying to put their own spin on it. And why I love Magic.
There's no overstating how important and influential Magic is in the whole history of game design. It is absolutely fundamental now.
We agree, right? And it's not often that a game comes along and kind of opens up an entire industry, right? And it had a significant impact. And now, of course, there have been times in the doldrums of gaming where Magic was credited with keeping hobby gaming alive. Right. Do you think that's an exaggeration?
It may not be an exaggeration. I mean, I don't think hobby gaming would ever go away, but I do feel like there are components of that industry that depend heavily on Magic sales to stay afloat. And I think that we're doing what we can to make sure that hobby gaming is accessible to everyone. And that's part of our mission. And it's because we think that it really does enrich people's lives. And it certainly helps me wake up and go to work in the morning.
So one of the things that you said that I found very interesting is you said it had an impact on game design, period, like the history of game design. Do you believe that Magic has had an impact that will actually be measurable in 100 years?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I think that Magic and actually to a much greater extent Dungeons and Dragons have very measurable impacts and have a lot of influence over the games that came after them.
Yeah.
You look at like a video game where you have hit points or something, like that is a concept that came from Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And leveling up is a Dungeons and Dragons thing. I feel like for Magic, it's about embracing randomness and the sort of exciting rush that you get when you encounter an unexpected situation and have to respond to it.
Right. But level up wasn't a great mechanic for Magic.
No, it's definitely not one of my favorites. When we tried to recapture and cycle that around again, I'm not super happy with how that worked out.
All of my opponents really, really hate my Lighthouse Chronologist. Really hate him. My Kira Great Glass Spinner deck. Yeah, I think with D&D and Magic, you had a strange thing happened twice with Gygax and Garfield. Hey, both names start with G. Where you had two people that had, with Gygax it was, I want to be able to tell stories with my friends, interactive stories. And with Richard Garfield, the concept was he wanted to have a combination of baseball cards, trading cards with a game element, so and a collectible element. So combining gaming and the collectability. And then they were married coincidentally with these wonderful minds that they had for designing games. And things like that are flukes. We're very fortunate to have both those games as a culture. Very, very fortunate.
Absolutely.
Now, D&D and Magic are concentrated at Wizards.
Yes.
Yeah, it's fortunate the early Wizards folks were big fans of role-playing, and so they tried, they purchased it.
Yeah, Peter Adkisson was the original president of Wizards of the Coast, and when he made his millions, he was able to buy his favorite game. And, so now we are the stewards of this game, and we take that very seriously. We take very good care of it, and we try not to do anything that would ruin it, because ultimately, while we own the game in a legal sense, it doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the people who play it.
Right. Who designed Hornet Queen?
Oh, that would be Aaron Forsyth.
Can you shake Aaron Forsyth firmly by the hand from all of us here at Commandroom?
Yep. Hornet Queen is the friend of the show card.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I do appreciate value, and so I appreciate Hornet Queen on that axis. And I do like seeing the colors Mark Rosewater's face turns whenever anyone mentions that card. So that's always fun, too.
Yeah, and then it was reprinted in Standard. Oh, I saw that, and I knew. By then, I had met Mark and was listening to his podcast, and I knew he was freaking out about that.
Yeah, he was really worried that all of these little Death Touch tokens were going to make it so that the Dragons of Tarkir wouldn't be able to succeed and shine the way that they should. But I think it all turned out okay. I think those dragons are sufficiently popular.
Do you ever see a card and immediately go, like, Mark's going to freak when he sees that?
Sometimes, yeah. The worst ones are the ones that I don't see. It's like, it's my job to see this, and I didn't see it. And I feel a little bad about that sometimes, but, he's had, you know, over 20 years of working on this game, and so his senses are a little more attuned than mine are sometimes to, color pie violations, cards that do things that cards of their color shouldn't do.
Do you have to cut one of your fingers off when you violate the color pie?
Yeah, yeah. We only need one hand to hold magic cards. So right. we get five strikes and then we're out of the company.
And as a lead designer, you have a strong second, so they can run the file. You don't actually need to type.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We should talk.
So do you have advanced one-handed shuffling skills, or do you have butlers who shuffle the decks for you?
I still have three fingers left on my right hand. Great. They were very nice. They let me keep my thumb on that side, so I'm still all right. I'm still able to function on my own.
He's only angered Rosewater twice then, unless he's lost his toes already. You mentioned Bart Rosewater sitting on a huge throne with a can of soda at one side, wearing a necklace of fingers.
Oh no, he never drinks soda.
Oh, what does he drink? I'm intrigued to know, because I've heard him drink it so many times.
Infant blood.
No, he doesn't eat anything interesting or drink anything interesting. He eats the same sandwich for lunch every day and just drinks a giant thing of water.
Yeah. So does he call you in and saying, "You violated the color pie," and we all know what that means?
That's when my blood freezes and my hair stands on end, and I know that it's going to be a long day at the office.
That's great, Ethan. That's wonderful. Do you know who is the heir apparent for Mark's job? Is it you?
I don't know. I sometimes think it's me, but then I look at his job and I'm like, that guy does way too much. So I think that probably what's really would happen if he quit his job is that like three or four people would kind of fight over the scraps and divide it up, because he does way too much work. The guy sleeps for like 4 hours a day and he's working on magic for almost all of the other hours of the day. So I'm far too lazy to invest that kind of energy.
Yeah, I recently turned on Tumblr's notifications, and I think that Mark and I have a similar schedule, because I'll see his Tumblr, like, he's answering Tumblrs at 2 a.m. sometimes. Yeah. And then right around the time I wake up, more Tumblrs are coming in. So that's like 6:30 sometimes.
Yeah, it's totally, he's over the top. Yeah. I don't think anybody could match him. And like, all of us who work under him are younger than he is, but he has more energy than anybody.
Before we move on to Oath, one very quick question from me. If you got your job through an apprentice style competition, is Mark Rosewater going to run for president?
I can only hope.
Excellent.
Things would be much more exciting around here if he was the president.
What did you do before the Great Designer Search 2?
So my day job was as a bookseller. I worked at Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon, which is the largest bookstore in the Western U.S.
I may have met you.
It's entirely possible. I met a lot of people working there. That was one of the great things about working there, is that all of these people who loved books would come into the store and you'd get to meet them, but not for too long. And so I did that, and I did a little bit of animation work and web design on the side. So yeah, that was what I did. And when the contest came along, I thought, oh, I missed the last one. I wasn't paying attention. I'm gonna do this one because I'll feel silly if I don't do it. And I wasn't taking it seriously. I was just like, aha, I'll just do this. And I kind of filled out the initial questionnaire in a pretty cavalier way and wrote some rather silly things on there. And as time went on, it became more and more serious because it seemed more and more likely that I would win. You know, the chances just got better and better. And once we got to the finals, there were eight of us left, and the first one or two of the challenges, the big challenges, were completed, it became clear to me that I was probably going to win. I really felt like I had the edge, and it was all working together, and the judges really seemed to like my stuff. So that's when I seriously buckled down and put in a lot of hours on winning that contest.
You were like, whoa, this is serious.
Yeah, this is serious. This could be my ticket out of this bookstore job because, you know, the book industry, it's not doing so great right now.
There's,
it's becoming a bit obsolete. I don't think that books will ever disappear or anything, but it was starting to look a little hairy there. And I was like, you know what? I've been doing this for 15 years. I think it's time to find something else to do.
Were you an active player at the time?
Yeah, my friends at the bookstore and I had a league. We would draft whatever the latest set was or do a flashback draft of some other older set and then just play with the cards for like a month and a half or something, play with our decks. So it was a very economical way to play Magic.
Yeah. Were you a role player? Like, where do you think your world design instincts come from? Or
well,
skills?
More accurately? You know, I read a lot of fantasy and science fiction novels,
yeah,
and did a lot of role playing games, you know, all the way through high school. And then, you know, to a certain extent after that. Oh, yeah, I guess. Yeah, we were also the bookstore group. We were playing Dungeons and Dragons a lot also, now that I think of it. So, yeah, avid role player, avid Magic player, avid miniatures war gamer. And just I have an omnivorous interest in games of all kinds and in just interesting things of all kinds. I have a liberal arts degree and just study anything that interests me.
Hopefully the degree is in some way related. Was it a writing degree or an English history degree or?
It was communication focusing in film and video production. So, and then I have another degree in animation. So I really feel like that in particular really helped me when it came to both the contest and my work now. Just the creative collaboration with a lot of people, you know, put your ego in check and do your part of the work that needs to be done to make the whole project work. You know, those were the kinds of skills that I really picked up while I was studying animation. And
that's
they
great.
Really have served me in good stead since then, even though I'm not animating anything.
It sounds like you had kind of the creative process, at least in those particular fields, and you knew what that creative process was and could apply it to other aspects.
Yeah, and the ability to accept criticism and critique and take it in the spirit in which it's intended and use it to improve yourself is something that is not easy for a lot of people. And it's almost a skill in and of itself, how to listen to a critique and use it to improve yourself. And it's a super valuable skill because you're not going to get that very often.
No.
If you're working in a creative field, most of the time people are either going to just, you know, tell you what they think you want to hear. Oh, that's great. Good job. You're wonderful. Or they're just going to say, you're not what we're looking for. We're going to hire someone else. So the ability to get, you know, really use those critiques that you get, which are very rare, is a valuable skill.
Did you bring George Lucas up deliberately?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a classic example of somebody who was surrounded by people who didn't work with him in a creatively collaborative form situation. He surrounded himself with yes men, from what I understand.
Yeah.
Right.
And people who were fans of his and weren't able to tell him, geez, George, this thing you're trying to do is a terrible idea. What if we try this?
Oh, you know? There was a guy who was worked closely on New Hope and Empire and then left before Jedi and it all went to hell in a handbasket after that.
It was Kirshner, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't Kirshner. It was someone else who was part of the writing team creative team really early on before Kirshner had anything to do with it and then left. And he was apparently, he had silence until a couple of years ago when suddenly he broke his silence about it all, and he was the no guy basically. He said, no, George, you need to think about this. And then when he went, that's when we got Ewoks and Jar Jar Binks and singing Muppets in Jabba's Palace and all that stuff.
Yeah, and I don't feel like there is nearly as much of a risk of something like that happening. It is rough and tumble in there. Like, you have to put your ego aside and just, like, accept that people are going to tell you if your ideas are terrible. And you should probably listen, because there's a good chance they know what they're talking about. And even if they don't, you'd better be prepared to defend yourself, you know? Defend your ideas.
Did Wizards consciously develop that culture, or did it come from just the need to produce the best sets possible?
I can't imagine that it was anything that was deliberately engineered, but it's the culture there, and it rubs some of the other departments the wrong way. Like, we are super frank and very critical in R&D, and there are some other departments where that can come off as obnoxious and overly critical and like a know-it-all attitude, and, you know, sometimes that leads to some friction.
Marketing.
So if Rosewater summoned you to his office and said, I won't do an impression, hey, Ethan, Ethan, we're thinking next set, full on, we want you to be lead designer. We're going back to Homelands and Alliances. This is going to be my masterpiece.
Oh, Grappa.
How do you say, no, Mark? Can you just say to him, I think that's a bad idea? Or is it that kind of environment? Or?
I mean, I don't think I would just say that's a bad idea. The best sort of feedback is actionable feedback and constructive criticism, right? And so I would talk about, like, what are the challenges with going back to Homelands, which honestly I can't go into all of them here. But and then I'd be like, well, Alliances, that was actually a really good set. I wouldn't mind going back there. Is there something we can do here? But yeah, it's very rare that it's just like, here's this idea, we're going to do it, don't question it. Like, that's not how we work. There's always lots of discussion, lots of argument, and there's no way where we'd get to the point where, like, we've already decided we're going back to Homelands, like, and I would be unaware of that. Like, we're all involved in a lot of the early planning, and like, I don't have like veto power or a vote or anything like that. I'm not high enough up in the hierarchy for that, but certainly I am given opportunities to pitch ideas. And then, of course, I'm heavily involved. Once we've decided we're going to do a block, I am usually heavily involved in planning what that block is going to look like. I'm involved in what we call the exploratory design team, which is the blue sky design at the very beginning. So I do a lot of the very early planning on the blocks that we're going to do before we get to design proper.
Cool. Were you part of the exploratory design for Oath of the Gatewatch and Battle for Zendikar?
I was. I was on that team. So we did a lot of thinking about, like, what will fans expect if we go back to Zendikar? What kind of story can we tell, given that we sort of ended Rise of the Eldrazi on a cliffhanger and sort of cooked up the idea of this war between these beleaguered allies versus these overpowering Eldrazi monsters? And this was pretty soon after Pacific Rim came out, so we were really thinking about these just giant monsters coming out of the ocean and wrecking stuff, and so that influenced us a little bit. And it seems kind of silly now, because Pacific Rim is far in the past and nobody cares about it anymore, but some of us were quite taken with the visual aspect of that and the sense of scale of that film, and wanted to capture some of those just gigantic monsters in magic.
I actually still wear a bright yellow and blue bodysuit. I'm wearing one right now. Yeah, and you guys must have drawn a lot of influence from the Cthulhu mythos as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the initial inspiration for the Eldrazi were very much Cthulhu, and then like Galactus from Marvel Comics, this giant planet-eating entity.
The Kozilek plates.
They look like Galactus's helmet.
They have a Kirby-esque look to them.
Yeah. And all, and instead of eyeballs, they could be like circles, all connected
the Kirby
by stripes.
Crackle.
Yeah.
Or they could have eyeballs in their armpits, like Kozilek.
Yeah, what's with that? What does he see? What is he looking for?
Well, I was just looking at the Art of Magic the Gathering Zendikar, which I received for free because I'm a Wizards of the Coast employee, but you can purchase it in your local bookstore. And the eyes don't look directly at you. They just kind of wander around and look, and apparently he's looking at things that nobody can see. Nobody in our plane of reality can even see, because he is a pan-dimensional being. And so he's looking at stuff that's in the fourth spatial dimension or something.
Yeah, my theory was it was checking to see if he needed to shave his pits.
Oh, yeah.
I like the theory
that's another popular theory.
The different dimensions exist within his sweaty pits. How does he put on deodorant? That must really burn.
Well, he loses an awful lot of deodorant sticks. It just keeps slipping into that other dimension.
It's expensive.
I'd like to imagine if you were on Zendikar Phil, Kozlek's coming down to destroy you and drain your home town of all its energy, and you're just standing there giving the finger saying, "Where's your deodorant stick now, you big bleep?"
I'm sorry, I'm trying not to break. That's pretty much the way it would go, Sean.
Bottle of rum in your other hand.
Yeah.
Nate
yeah.
comatosed at your feet.
So, yeah. Well, if Nate's there, the bottle would be a tequila bottle, and it would be empty. So
I wouldn't want to face Kozlek any other way.
What, than drunk?
So the set started with exploratory design, and Mark has talked about how you kind of put everything up on the board, like what is Zendikar? But then how did, from a design perspective, you're going to tell a story with the mechanics and with the individual cards. So how did you decide the way that story would evolve? And I know as a second set, you kind of had to take a lead from the first set, almost by definition. Were you at the one-year process by this time, or were you still at a four-month process for the second set?
The second set, it was more than 4 months, but less than a year. I think we had about 8 months of design, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
We basically picked up right... I was on the Battle for Zendikar design team, so I was there for the whole first half of the journey of that set being made. And then when that team ended, I immediately picked up and started working on Oath of the Gatewatch as the lead designer of that set with a new team. And the first thing we wanted to do was figure out, what is Kozlek doing here? We knew that one of the things that we had planned out was that Ulamog would be the focus of the first set and Kozlek would be the focus of the second set in order to give them some definition. Mm. And so we tried to figure it out, who is Kozlek? What is he like? What are his interests? And, how can we express those things mechanically? And so Ulamog is the eater. He likes to eat everything. And Kozlek is the reality warper. He has a sphere of influence around him, and his sort of sub-Eldrazi that are part of his brood lineage have the same effect of, warping the laws of physics and altering perception wherever they go. So we experimented with a bunch of different mechanics there to... simulate that in Magic the Gathering terms. And there were a lot of little interesting things, but nothing that felt like it was deep enough to make a whole keyword mechanic out of and put on 20 cards or so. So what we decided eventually was that we would take this colorless mana cost mechanic that my friend John Laux had designed for his Great Designer Search 2 submission. And this was a thing where you had to pay colorless mana, a new mana symbol, instead of paying any color. You could only pay with colorless mana like Sol Ring makes.
Mm.
I was really excited about this idea when I saw it in his submission, and it seemed like a great thing for the Eldrazi. We had this devoid mechanic, we had these cards that cared about casting colorless spells and colorless creatures, and it just felt like, okay, this is it. We're all about colorlessness here. We have this creature that is deliberately difficult to define, so why not take mana that is itself undefined and use that to sort of tie together all these little mechanics, and then make those abilities of creatures that require this colorless mana to activate or to cast. So that was the first thing. We had to nail Kozlek, and I feel pretty good about it. I feel like we came up with something really exciting and splashy that nobody had ever seen before, and it feels like Kozlek. It feels like strange things are happening, but then when the monster has moved on, they are no longer going on. And then, of course, we have this overarching story. One of the things that we're working on right now is long-term storytelling, like back when we had the Weatherlight saga a long time ago. This went on for years. We had a big, long story arc. So we're trying to do that again. And the key story beat that's happening when Oath of the Gatewatch, the set is set, is that these planeswalkers are forming a team called the Gatewatch. So we really wanted to reflect that idea of teaming up in the allies and with the planeswalkers in the set, and then with the surge mechanic that rewards you for having a teammate in like Two-Headed Giant or Emperor or Archenemy or whatever. As sort of the player is the analog for a planeswalker. That's the fundamental conceit of the game. You are a planeswalker and you're casting these spells. So we wanted to capture that mechanically.
that kind of focus on knowing what the story was with this, you know, the Guardians of the Gate to Sea forming an alliance of super friends, and you decided to kind of capitalize that and make it make the second set very team oriented. Is that why it's two-headed giant? So you could play the two, you know, two super friends, let's say, or represent that, and face off potentially against the two titans.
Absolutely, you you can team up, and you know, just like the Gatewatch is teaming up.
Yeah,
that's great.
Can I be Jace?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you should be yourself. You should be Sean, but or whatever your wizard name is. Do you have a wizard?
No,
name?
Don't tell him that. Don't
no,
tell
then
him
he has
that.
Power over me.
No, I mean, don't tell him to be himself, Ethan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize what a risky proposition.
I can be the missing Black Planeswalker from the Gatewatch if you want.
Did Obnixilus take away from the villainy of Kozilek?
We wanted somebody who had a little more of a recognizable face for some of the story here. The Eldrazi are fundamentally very difficult to identify with, and that's by design. We wanted to make them inscrutable alien monstrosities with no human concerns whatsoever. And
Nate?
Having someone who was...
What?
Who was evil...
Do you have trouble identifying with the Eldrazi? Yeah, I'm teasing because, you know, this is what
you say.
Do.
You're an unscrutable humanless being.
Who wants inscrutable alien monstrosity?
Who only wants to consume and destroy.
Destroy Rakdos.
Sounds familiar.
So obviously some people can identify with that, but there are other people who are just kind of angry and selfish and like to crush people's dreams and really get emotionally invested in that. I think a lot of Magic players fall into that category, and we wanted Obnixilus to be there as sort of a villain that they could identify with a little better, as a more recognizable motivation.
Well, he does that, and I think Nick Davidson wrote the Obnixilus half of the Uncharted Realms that was released recently, and I think he captured that kind of smugness, like he's been around for a long time, and so, you know, he knows how to deal with these young upstarts.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens.
Nick Davidson is just absolutely incredible human being, and I have had the pleasure of role-playing with him and playing Magic with him and now reading his stories, and he is always entertaining.
That's excellent. From a mechanical perspective, how did you select the archetypes that were supported, both in Limited and then, of course, you know, you have to design for Commander and all of the other formats, too. So how did you decide what archetypes to support?
A lot of what we did was take our lead from Battle for Zendikar. We, in Limited, the sets need to play together because you're going to draft two packs of Oath of the Gatewatch, and then you're going to draft a pack of Battle for Zendikar. So the cards need to connect together in a satisfying way. So about half of the Limited color pair archetypes are the same or roughly similar between the two sets, with some changes to shake things up a little bit, but strategically very similar. And then we decided to shake things up in ways that we felt could work. We have the colorless mana abilities that connect to some of the colorless mana and the Eldrazi Scion tokens from Battle for Zendikar, and we changed up the allies so that they work in a different way, so they're more of a build-up kind of combo deck instead of an aggro deck. And then the Surge mechanic is a bit of a turn to left field, as it were. It was more aimed at Constructed. I wanted to have the Surge mechanic connect in Standard to Khans of Tarkir, to the Jeskai clan. They have the prowess and all of the prowess enablers. And I feel like the Surge cards really fit well with those cards.
I really like Surge.
So it was designed not only to enable you to play with a teammate, but also in Constructed to play with the Jeskai.
Very cool. Surge is great. If I was to nod back a little bit to Overload in the way it plays, but cheapens the spell rather than makes it more expensive.
Yeah, or like, to me it was like a fixed version of Storm, where you want to play lots of small spells and then you get them with a big punch at the end. Yeah. In this case, you only have to do one additional spell, but it's probably not going to be as broken as Storm.
Storm broken? Never.
Yeah, Surge, the first couple of cards to be spoiled with Surge, people were, you know, we go up to mythicspoilers.com and we're checking that out, but people were like, oh, this is terrible. I'm like, really? Do you only ever cast one spell a turn?
I just love doing that. I just love casting a bunch of spells.
Right?
It's so fun. Especially if each one draws a card, that's even better.
You need to remember as well, as soon as you put anything gaming-wise, this is applied when I worked at Games Workshop, as soon as anything goes out into public domain, immediately, even if it's the best thing in the world, zero to cast, take X free turn, like extra turns after this one, someone will say, this is the worst card ever printed. And
right, and it's easy to imagine, like, I can imagine how to make this card more powerful. You knock a mana off, or you make it do one more damage, you make the creature slightly bigger. Didn't you guys think of that? It's a little frustrating sometimes, but turns out we do play test these things, and we aren't just trying to make the most powerful cards that have ever been made, because if we did that, there would be no Magic the Gathering in a couple of years' time. The game would be destroyed.
Right.
So we have to try to keep everything at about the same average power level, with variation in, you know, up or down on individual cards, and then focusing the power of whatever is in Standard in different areas of the game in different years, so that Standard isn't always the same.
Yeah. How often do you guys delete tweets that are, you know, the response is like, wow, we never thought of adding one more power to that creature.
Yeah, I can't speak for everyone. I don't think Aaron Forsyth ever deletes tweets. I haven't seen any evidence that he has. But I certainly think twice before posting on social media, and very frequently just delete it and feel smart for having not gotten fired that day.
Yeah, it's been a near thing for me a couple of times. What about the support ability? How did that come about?
So support is something that makes me a little bit sad. It didn't quite turn out the way I had planned it to. Support is an ability that it says support, and it has a number after it, and it goes on instants and sorceries, or on creatures, you know, in the abilities. And basically support puts a +1/+1 counter on however many creatures are in the number after the keyword. So if it says support 3, you can put a +1/+1 counter on up to 3 target creatures. So you can use this to help your creatures, help your teammates' creatures, you know, make something big so you can hit it with Smite the Monstrous or whatever. You put them anywhere. Originally, in design, it could also put loyalty counters on planeswalkers. So the idea was
that you could either, in
limited, you could just pump up your creatures, but in constructed, you could pump up your creatures and your planeswalkers. This was an idea of, like, everybody's banding together, the planeswalkers are teaming up, put a bunch of planeswalkers in your deck. That'll be fun.
You know that... Narset Transcendent is currently in Standard, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm reckless. And as it turned out, the development team were able to figure out that Narset Transcendent and a bunch of other planeswalkers were in Standard. And that there wasn't a way to balance pumping up creatures and pumping up planeswalkers in a satisfying way. And so at the very last minute, very late in development, they ended up having to cut the planeswalker part out.
Yeah, I bet they did.
So now it only helps creatures, which makes me a little bit sad, but it's still fun to play with in Limited, even if it doesn't read as a very sexy or exciting mechanic.
Look, Ethan, we're not currently playing in a Standard environment set on Zendikar where there's a Jace Planeswalker running rampant on the Standard scene and appearing in every... Oh, hang on.
Yeah.
Maybe the developers know what they're talking
about.
Yeah,
almost.
Is it Oath of Gideon that puts the extra counter on a planeswalker?
Yes, yeah. So at least we were able to salvage that on a single card. And I'm really happy with those Oath cards. They're sort of the emblematic cards of the set that really, they're the face of the set, really. Literally, there's the faces of these planeswalkers. And I'm very happy with how those shook out.
Yeah, folks who've listened to the previews, the preview episodes we've done for Oath of the Gatewatch know that we've used the term bonkers a couple of times. And if support had done that, we would have focused on nothing else.
Yeah, I think support would have been into doubling season levels of silliness for Super Friends decks if it did it on Planeswalkers as well.
Yeah, it could have been. My Progenitus deck is still sad that it didn't all work out.
The way you said could have been then, sir.
Yeah.
Lamenting the loss, whereas I was pleased it didn't happen.
Yeah, well, I admit I sometimes design cards specifically for my own commander decks. Sometimes they're even printed, and then they just fit right in there exactly where I'd planned them to go.
That's great. You must have done that. Like, oh, this will be great in this deck. And then when it gets through the development process, you're like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the most recent example would be Scourge of Clan Nel'Toth, Zombie Dragon. I really needed a big flyer for my Grimgrin zombie deck. And so I was not ashamed. I begged to make sure that this thing would turn out to be a zombie dragon that was mono black. And it worked. I pulled it off.
That is awesome, sir. That's wonderful. How many of us have wanted to design our own magic card for a particular deck?
Can you beg for them to produce a Planeswalker Gix card for me, please? Planeswalker Gix.
Well, I don't think Gix is a Planeswalker. Gix is a Phyrexian Praetor, I believe.
Yeah, that doesn't... Okay, that's fine.
And the Phyrexians cannot hold the Planeswalker spark. It's part of their nature.
Fine then. Okay, he can be... he'll be a legendary... Okay, Yawgmoth is a legendary creature. Go on.
I did try to do that in Commander 2014. I was like, what if we did Yawgmoth? And my creative team was like, really, Yawgmoth? Do you know what you're saying? I was like, maybe I do. But they really sold me on the idea of doing Jisa and Giralf instead. And I'm so happy with how they turned out. They are just, they're so adorable.
Is it Jisa? Is that how it's pronounced? Because I've heard...
Well, that's how I pronounce it. I don't know
the real pronunciation. The designer of the cards, I'm going with Jisa then.
Yeah. So, I just love how he, like, she chops zombies in half to get two zombies, and
yeah, that's
he
great.
Sews them together to make one bigger zombies. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful symmetry. I can imagine. Did Doug Beyer, like, lower his glasses and look at you and say, Yawgmoth, really?
I, for fun, designed a Yawgmoth card and used a picture of Phil as the artwork.
All I ask is that we see a lot more Proliferate cards reprinted without the Phyrexian watermark or the Phyrexian mana cost.
All right. I love Proliferate, so you don't have to sell me on this. I will try to make Proliferate happen wherever and whenever I can.
Excellent. I'm a firm believer that if a card is cleansed of its Phyrexian influences, the mechanics can be salvaged for those of us who wish to do good with them.
I think so. There's plenty of good to be done with Proliferate.
In a roundabout way, it's an awkward segue, but to cohort, the ability cohort. And so we got there because Proliferate reminds me of Nate, and Nate plays the Alicia Allies deck, and...
It makes absolute sense. It was a flawless transition.
Smooth. Yeah.
That is the segue of a professional podcaster, sir.
I believe. So, yeah, the cohort ability, originally we had a different ability. It was a very aggressive ability, super aggressive, and it was too aggressive. It was not actually any fun. There was so much aggression in the set, and...
Tell me more.
We kind of missed... This thing that the allies had in original Zendikar, where you could build up, and they all just like comboed together somehow, and like it felt like you were making something instead of just like getting triggered abilities and then swinging into the red zone. So we wanted to try to make more of a build up ally deck instead of an aggro ally deck. So I formed a mini team. Every once in a while, when we have a problem of very defined scope, we'll form a mini team and meet for a week or two, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week. And it's just like a very temporary team. So I led this ally mini team. We came up with a bunch of different ally mechanics that all built up and formed a machine of allies, basically. And the one that we really liked, that the development team liked the best, was this cohort ability that was based on Catapult Squad from Onslaught, where you would tap soldiers to deal damage to things. And I always loved that. I had a soldier tribal deck, and I loved Catapult Squad and those cards like that. And we were able to put all kinds of different effects on the allies with cohort, so that, you know, if you need to buy yourself some time, let's gain some life. Oh, we have impenetrable defense now because we can block and then activate our abilities. We don't have to attack anymore. We can just ping you with this other ally. And there's different allies with different jobs. And depending on which ones you draw, you can assemble a different kind of ally machine with them. I think it's a lot of fun, and it's a refreshing change from the very heavily attack incentivizing environment that was Battle for Zendikar, what with the you know, all the Eldrazi that were very aggressive in red and black, and the landfall ability is a very aggressive ability, and then the rally ability is very aggressive. In a lot of ways, rally is very similar to landfall. Like, something comes in, something triggers, and you'd better take advantage of it now because it's going away by the end of the turn, you know? So we wanted to change things just about as much as we could while still being true to the setting and the storyline, so that there would be a big variety of experience when the new set came into the environment.
I feel like cohort for me is what the Boros Guild should have done. It would have made Boros as a color.
Oh, that's interesting.
That would have made Boros a much more interesting. When I think military, lots of small guys building up to become greater than the sum of their parts, rather than just, I'm smashing in the face, which is what Boros does, this is what it should have done.
That is a very interesting insight. If we ever go back to Ravnica, I'll keep it in mind.
Ooh.
But we may never go back there. Nobody likes that.
No,
everyone hates
it's
Ravnica.
The worst place. Yeah. It's dirty, noisy, crowded, smells bad.
You can't find a parking spot.
No, never. That is interesting. It is kind of the opposite of Battalion, isn't it? The defensive posture for Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. So, Ethan, we have enjoyed our time with you, and we know that, very sadly for us, it grows short. I want to include some of the listener questions, though. We like to pride ourselves, as you were talking about early on, how Wizards interacts with the community. We interact with our community, too. We actually play test decks with some of our listeners. So, Nate, you're kind of the king of the lightning question round. Do you want to start asking these questions? And maybe you and Sean alternate?
Okay.
All right, lightning round.
I'm going to read this next one as an angry internet person.
Okay.
Chris Longton asks, whose idea was Wastes? And why wasn't Void good enough to represent Eldrazi in the second set?
So we used the Devoid mechanic for all of the Eldrazi, and then each of the Brood lineages got their own mechanic. So Ulamog got the Ingest mechanic, and Kozilek got the Colorless Mana Symbol mechanic. Wastes were the idea of Barry Reich, which was one of the original playtesters for Magic the Gathering that worked with Richard Garfield back in the misty days of the early 90s. And he included a basic land that tapped for colorless mana in his initial draft of the Invasion set, what became the Invasion set, as a way to increase your domain score from 5 to 6. So we took that idea, got rid of the part where it increased domain because it doesn't work very well in the rules, and just made a basic land that taps for colorless.
Badoom! There you go. Right, so Magic the Podcast at Magic the Podcast asks, what were you thinking? ? Then, but seriously, lots of format-changing cards. Love to know the thought process.
I was thinking, let's make a magic set. And then we did. Lightning round.
Tyler Copeland at Galanis270. In Oath, what inspired the push to team play? Does this indicate shifts in WotC format support?
That's a good one.
The inspiration for the team play came from the storyline, the overarching multi-set storyline that we're trying to tell here. The most important thing that happened here was the Planeswalkers formed a team, and so we wanted the player experience to mirror the character's experience. So we have the mechanics and cards that support team play. I don't believe this represents any sort of sea change in what Wizards of the Coast is planning to support, but I will point out that the Two-Headed Giant format has been increasing in popularity over the years and is more popular now than it ever has been.
That's great.
Excellent. MTG_Prowess at MTG Prowess asks, what was the decision to add colorless symbols to Oath of the Gatewatch? Was it done by design? If so, how long was it in the air before it became a sure thing? I think we kind of answered this already, but give it a quick version.
Yeah, it was something we established very early in design. It's hard for me to say when it was a sure thing. Like, I held the cards in my hand today, and that's when I knew it was a sure thing, if that answers the question.
It sure does.
Eric Landis at Proggy Boog asks, how much rework was required on Oath of the Gatewatch given the change from 3-set to 2-set blocks during design?
Zero rework. The change from the 3-set block to the 2-set block happened during exploratory design, I believe. It's been quite a few years now, but that's my recollection. So, yeah, by the time we got to Oath of the Gatewatch design, that decision had been made for over a year. So, no rework at all.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out you are actually a time traveler from 2 years in the future.
That's true. I can tell you that there will be magic there.
and final listener question that we're going to do on the quickfire round from Shivan Bart at Electrotal. What story characters do you wish you could have put into C14? Good question.
One. We know it's Yawgmoth.
We went through so many story characters. I really, really wish that I could have put Jaya Ballard into C-14.
Oh, yeah.
By the time we figured out that we could do old school planeswalkers, the design for the red deck had solidified and was working very well. And I didn't want to break it apart and start over. And Jaya Ballard is not an artificer. She does not make artifacts. I'm sure she would melt them down given the opportunity. But she is sort of the prototype that that led to Chandra Nalar, who's our pyromancer now. But Jaya Ballard was lighting things on fire back when back during the Ice Age block, and is the originator of some of the greatest flavor text in all of Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
So I feel sad that we missed that, but I'm sure that I will find a way to make a Jaya Ballard Planeswalker card eventually.
Back when she was a mere task mage.
Yes. We do at least have Jaya Ballard Task Mage to tide us over until the happy day when we get the Planeswalker card.
Okay, the last question is the big one. Steve Horton at Tropical Steve asks, how do they keep Commander in mind when a new set is designed?
Way to go, Steve. Great question.
That rhymes.
It does.
A lot of the time, I guess these days, we've sort of shifted our philosophy on this over the years. The way I like to think about Commander when I'm working on a set like Oath of the Gatewatch is I mostly focus on legendary creatures. I try to think, if I were somebody buying this set and I want to see these legendary creatures, I want to say, oh, that's exciting, I want to make a deck with that. And I look at somebody like Jorien Ruindiver, right? This is a legendary creature, blue-red, that whenever you cast your second spell in a turn, you can draw a card. So this was designed directly to support the surge mechanic, to work with the surge mechanic. So you need look no farther than this very set to find cards that would go great in a commander deck with Jorien Ruindiver. So that's my approach when I'm working on an expert level set. Just get some sweet legendary creatures in there that seem appealing. Maybe they are good enough to play in standard, but certainly they encourage you to build a deck with them with cards from this very set, because that just seems like the most satisfying way to do it in an organic way that makes a lot of sense within the design of the set.
Why is it that you have such a team and multiplayer commander, if you will, focus? Did you play a lot of multiplayer Magic? How did you get involved with... You're on every one of the design teams since 2013.
Yeah, wow, that's a good question. I guess I do play a lot of Commander. It wasn't my favorite format when I started working at Wizards of the Coast, but it quickly grew to become my favorite format. And it was a good way for me to sort of have a palate cleanser after Journey into Nyx, my first set. It was a way for me to work on something not quite as demanding and, take a little break, cool down, think about lessons learned, and then eventually I was able to move on to Oath of the Gatewatch. And I don't know, I just keep being on them year after year. I'm on one of these teams. I guess I'm good at it. I don't know.
Did you kind of take over the lead role when Dan Emmons left?
Dan Emmons left after design was complete for Commander 2015. So he was able to see it through all the way. And actually, we invited him back to, once the cards had all been laid out, we invited him back to the slideshow, which we usually do after all the editing is done and the typesetting is done. So we can kind of look on our work and appreciate it and make sure that no last minute problems are there. So Dan got to go all the way to the end with his set. And then he decided to move on to greener pastures.
That is so cool that you brought him back for the slideshow.
Yeah, it was his only set. It was his only set he led. We couldn't let him miss it.
No. Yeah, that's very nice.
Like when you're designing a set like Journey into Nyx, sorry, just to quickly on the design, a card like Worst Fears, do you design that just saying this will only see play in Commander?
No, I don't think so. Like, there are a lot of cards that we'll design. Sometimes they won't be for standard. They won't be pushed for standard, and they'll be for casual play, but not necessarily just for Commander. I think that there are a lot of people who just play kitchen table Magic and don't even know what formats are, and just sit around the table like you used to in the old days and play Magic. Something like, I was on the Magic 2013 development team, and we had a card in there, Worldfire, I think, that just destroyed everything and reduced everyone's life to one. And
yes, I'm aware
that's
of it.
Not a good card for Commander. That's not a, you know, it's not a good card for Standard. Nobody's going to play that in Standard either. But it's just like, this is a cool card. This is Sudden Death Round. We've got to make this work. We each have one life. Who's going to win? Who's going to get in that last point of damage, right? So a lot of time sometimes we're just designing cool cards. And if they're a little too oppressive to be costed low enough to be Standard playable, then they become casual cards. And and people can enjoy them in whatever context. And sometimes that's Commander, and sometimes it's somewhere else, and sometimes we misjudge it, and they end up getting played in competitive tournaments. And we're like, whoops, well, that's interesting. Didn't expect that to happen.
And somebody loses a finger.
Yep, that's when the developers lose their fingers.
That's excellent.
Oh, man. Siege Rhino, you wouldn't believe how many fingers were all over the ground from that.
Wow. We have hours and hours of conversation left in us, but there's no way. And we are past the agreement we made at the beginning of the show. And
Blake has just woken up in the background as well. Yeah, it's like he knew.
So the child of Alara.
The child of Alara knows.
So, Ethan, how can people reach you? What's the best way to reach you?
So probably the easiest way nowadays is I'm on Twitter at Ethan Fleischer. No spaces in between. Capital letters where you would expect them. ETHANFLEISCHER. Or you can email me at my Wizards of the Coast email address, ethan.fleischer@wizards.com. And I am always happy to talk to Magic fans about Magic because it's one of my favorite things.
If you had to do an impression of Kozilek, what would it sound like?
Well, Dave Guskin, who unfortunately no longer works at Wizards, he was the best one at doing the Eldrazi impression, but I'm going to try. I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but I'll do my best here.
And that's all of the broods, or was that sounded sort of like an Ulamog?
Yeah, I'm not sure which one he was doing. And as I said, I probably didn't do it. Maybe he was doing Ulamog and now I just did Kozilek. I don't know.
Well,
I like to imagine Emrakul says, "Hello, my name's Emrakul." Yeah,
very refined lady there, Emrakul. Yes.
Work the word poppet into design when you finally do get to Emrakul.
Those adorable little poppets.
Hello, poppet. Who wants their aeons torn?
This has been excellent, Ethan. Thank you for taking the time. I know our listeners don't realize this, but we're recording on a Friday. It's been the end of what is undoubtedly a hectic work week. Thank you for taking the time and coming on our show.
You're absolutely welcome. This was super fun. I'd love to come on some other time.
You're more than welcome.
We would love to have you. Yeah, this has been wonderful. And again, we still have hours of conversation, so maybe we'll pick up where we left off, sort of like the Zendikar cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
Or time travelers,
yes. Ethan, as Wizards appreciates its community, we love our listeners as well. They're fun. They tell us what they think. They're not shy at all. Some of them even playtest decks with us. We get up on Skype, we use a client, and we kind of evaluate cards and deck combinations before we go out and we actually manifest them in paper. And with the three of us being in three different locations and our listeners, all of course, being global, we meet a lot of really interesting people, and that's one of the ways that we get close to them. Hopefully they'll contact us, they'll let us know what they thought of this episode, and just in general, just tell us what they think. The theme song that you referenced earlier, right? The Rawhide-like theme song was created for the show by Mr. Nate Burgess.
Mm-hmm.
Our logo was created for the podcast by Mr. Picto, who is available at mrpicto.co.uk with assistance from Kelly DeLuca. Special thanks to our tech whizzes, Jesse Thompson and Graham Frank, and to Justin for his server space. You can reach us by going to our website and leaving comments on any of the episodes you want at commanderinmtg.com. Our email is, strangely enough, cast@commanderinmtg.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, mtgcast.com, podbay.fm, Reddit, and, of course, Skype by searching for CommanderinMTG Podcast. Individually, on Twitter, I'm at Ketchak.
I'm at Copain26.
I'm at Mr. Plorg.
And Ethan, of course, you're...
I'm at Ethan Fleischer, and that's our show.
Awesome!